Imagine, right? You walk into this world-renowned museum and you find the grandest, like the most heavily promoted exhibit they
Oh,
have.
yeah, the one with the huge banners outside.
Exactly. And you step confidently right through the doorway and you just find yourself in a completely empty, brilliantly illuminated white room, like nothing on the walls at all.
Just dark white space.
Yeah. And that profoundly jarring experience is, well, it's basically exactly what happened with the source material we are looking at today. So, welcome to you, the listener, to another journey on the deep dive. You know the premise of this show by now. You send us your sources, you know, the articles, the research papers, those frantic 3 a.m. notes you took on some fascinating topic, and we sift through that stack.
We process it, we extract the crucial insights, and we try to hand you the essence of what you need to understand, so you don't have to read through a literal mountain of text.
Right. We basically do the heavy lifting.
Yeah, we essentially act as a filter for the overwhelming noise of the modern information landscape. We take all that raw data and attempt to synthesize it into something clear, structural, and, well, useful for you.
Which brings us to the mission for this specific deep dive. Today, we are focusing entirely on a document you provided to us, and the cover sheet simply reads, quote, "Excerpts from DNA and Genetic Code."
That's right.
So we brewed our coffee, we sat down, and we were completely prepared to wade into the incredibly complex biological waters of like inheritance and cellular machinery and the fundamental building blocks of life.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the title alone certainly primes the mind for a very specific, rigorous type of scientific analysis. When you see those words, DNA, genetic code, you immediately prepare to engage with some really dense biological framework.
Right. You brace yourself for the charts and the graphs. Okay, let's unpack this because we really have to address the reality of what you actually sent us.
We do.
We open the file, we scroll down looking for, you know, the paragraphs, the data tables, the historical context, the profound scientific revelations about how our cells function. And I am genuinely amused to report that we found absolutely nothing.
Nothing at all.
I'm operating under the assumption that maybe a file was corrupted during the upload, or perhaps like a copy-paste error occurred on your end, because the document you provided contains zero body text. There's no research, there are no articles. It is literally just the blank walls of that empty museum gallery.
Yeah, to be entirely precise about the boundaries of the artifact we have in front of us today, the complete sum of the source material reads, and I quote, "Excerpts from DNA and Genetic Code, DNA and Genetic Code."
That's it.
That is the entirety of the text. We have the introductory framing of the title, a repetition of the subject matter, and then the document simply ceases to exist. The promised excerpts are materially absent.
Which puts us in this wonderfully absurd, yet I think deeply intriguing position. Because the cardinal rule of the show is that we do not invent
Well,
information.
we don't.
We do not bring in outside textbooks to fill in the gaps of your sources. If you hand us a stack of papers, we analyze that stack. If you hand us a corrupted PDF that contains exactly five unique words, well, we're going to put those five words under an electron microscope.
Exactly.
We're going to spend this entire deep dive performing a forensic analysis on a ghost.
It's fascinating because it forces an entirely different methodology. When you are denied the body of a text, you are compelled to analyze the framing. We
Right.
cannot analyze the biology of DNA today based on your source, but we can rigorously analyze the signifiers. We can look at the historical, linguistic, and really the philosophical weight of the words you managed to transmit to us.
Staring at this title, I mean, it feels exactly like unrolling a beautifully aged, ornate treasure map. You see the compass rose, you see the sweeping calligraphy at the top that says, "Map to the greatest treasure in the world." But the rest of the parchment is completely blank.
But just blank paper.
Yeah, no coastlines, no mountains, no red X. As someone who spends their life analyzing data and information systems, here's where it gets really interesting. When we are handed this promising label, but absolutely no text to follow it, how do we even begin to evaluate the intent? What do you do with a blank map?
Well, you start by acknowledging that a blank map with a title still conveys a massive amount of structural information. It does not give you the location of the gold, obviously, but it tells you a great deal about the mind of the map maker.
Okay, how so?
It tells you about the nature of the journey they intended for you to take. What's fascinating here is if we look closely at the linguistics of the minimal text provided, the very first word we encounter is doing an extraordinary amount of heavy lifting, and that word is excerpts.
Yeah, let's talk about that word because excerpts isn't just a passive description, right? It implies an action has taken place before the document even reached us on our desks.
It implies a history of violence, intellectually speaking.
Oh, wow. Violence.
Well, yeah. Think about it. The word excerpts inherently requires the existence of a larger, more comprehensive original document. You cannot excerpt from a void.
Right.
An excerpt is a fragment plucked from a whole. Therefore, the immediate linguistic intent of this source is to declare itself as a curated experience. It is telling you that a vast, potentially overwhelming body of work on DNA and the genetic code exists somewhere out there, and an unseen editor made a conscious, deliberate decision to slice away the bulk of it.
They took a machete to the textbook.
Exactly.
They intended to present you only with the most vital, resonant pieces. It's an act of intellectual distillation, or, you know, at least the promise of one. The invisible curator looked at this massive mountain of biological data and essentially said, I am going to save the listener the trouble. I'm going to chop away the excess and just give them the core.
Yes.
But then ironically, the technical glitch chopped away everything else. They curated the text down to absolute zero.
The irony is palpable, for sure, but the structural intent remains significant. The intent was curation. And curation is arguably the most valuable intellectual service in the modern era. We exist in a landscape of complete information saturation.
Oh, absolutely. The anxiety of information overload is basically the defining hum of modern life. You wake up, you check your phone, and you are instantly hit with a tidal wave of data.
It's endless.
Yeah, articles, white papers, op-eds, podcasts. You constantly feel like you are falling behind on your understanding of the world just by virtue of not being able to read 10,000 words a minute.
It creates a state of chronic cognitive fatigue. There is always another definitive 500-page textbook you feel you are obligated to have read just to participate in a basic conversation.
Right.
So by labeling this document excerpts, the author was attempting to offer relief from that fatigue. They were offering a shortcut.
Like a lifeline.
Exactly. The concept of the excerpt is deeply tied to human cognitive limits. Our working memory can only hold so many variables at once. When dealing with a subject as unfathomably complex as the molecular basis of life, providing the whole picture all at once is pedagogically useless. It just overwhelms the receiver.
It's like trying to teach someone how a car works by dumping a pile of 30,000 individual car parts on their front lawn.
Yes.
It's technically all the information they need, but without curation, it's just a mess. The excerpt is the curated tour.
Exactly. And the history of science is essentially the history of better and better excerpts. A scientific model is just an excerpt of reality. We strip away the infinite complexity of the physical universe and extract only the mathematical or conceptual variables that matter for our specific prediction.
Okay, I see.
A map is an excerpt of a territory. If a map were perfectly comprehensive, it would have to be the exact same size as the territory it describes, rendering it completely useless.
That's a great point. So the promise of this document, before it, you know, glitched into oblivion, was that someone had already done the hard work of simplification. They had mapped the territory for us.
Right.
Let's look at the territory they intended to map. The text presents two distinct concepts joined by a conjunction, DNA and genetic code.
The structure here is vital. It doesn't just present a single topic. It places two massive conceptual pillars side by side and joins them with the word and.
DNA and genetic code.
Yeah.
It doesn't say DNA is the genetic code. It doesn't say the genetic code of DNA. It lists them as parallel entities.
And that conjunction is doing fascinating work in this empty space. By placing DNA and genetic code on either side of the word and, the title implies a complex, perhaps interdependent relationship between the two terms that the missing text was meant to explain.
Right. It's building a bridge.
It sets up an expectation in the reader's mind of comparison or mechanism.
It really reminds me of book titles like The Engine and the Automobile, or like The Ink and the Novel. It signals that these two things are deeply intertwined, but they are distinct enough to warrant being listed separately. The title is basically setting the stage for a narrative. It's whispering, I am going to tell you a story about how this tangible thing called DNA relates to this conceptual thing called a genetic code.
It establishes a duality between hardware and software. And to fully appreciate what this title is promising, we really have to look at the historical and linguistic weight of those two terms independently.
Okay, let's do it.
Let's start with the first half of the conjunction, DNA. Even without the body text, the presence of that acronym alone carries an immense amount of physical, material reality.
Just the letters, DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid. It grounds the entire document in physical chemistry.
It does. When the title invokes DNA, it is invoking a tangible molecule, a substance you can isolate in a test tube, a substance that has mass, a substance that interacts with light, a substance that has a specific, incredible, famous three-dimensional geometry, the double helix.
It's physical stuff. You can literally spool it on a glass rod if you extract it from a strawberry in a high school biology lab.
Yes.
Have you ever been that? Looks like white snotty thread.
A very apt, if slightly visceral, description. But that physicality is the point. Before anyone understood what DNA actually did, they knew what it was. It was a slightly acidic chemical found in the nucleus of cells.
Just sitting there.
Right. And for a long time in the early 20th century, biologists actually thought DNA was too simple, too chemically boring to be the carrier of genetic information.
Wait, really?
Oh, absolutely. They thought proteins, which are much more chemically complex and varied, had to be the secret to inheritance. DNA was just seen as a structural scaffold, a sort of cellular packing material.
Which makes the second half of the title so crucial. The title isn't just excerpts from DNA. If it were, the missing text could theoretically just be a dry chemical breakdown of sugar phosphate backbones and nitrogenous bases. It could just be a recipe for the molecule itself.
But the invisible author didn't stop there. They added the conjunction, and then they added the phrase genetic code. This is where the title pivots from organic chemistry into the realm of information theory.
Because a code is not a physical object. A code is an abstraction.
This is the most profound linguistic shift in the history of biology, and it is captured perfectly in the five words you provided. The use of the word code in biology is entirely borrowed from cryptography and computer science.
We completely take that for granted now. We talk about our genetic code the exact same way we talk about the code running the apps on our phones.
Mm-hmm.
But that wasn't always the case, was it? Biologists didn't always use computer metaphors.
They couldn't have, because computers as we know them didn't exist when the foundations of genetics were being laid. For centuries, biology was a science of observation, of cataloging shapes and behaviors, of dissecting physical forms.
Right.
It was about muscles, bones, tissues, and eventually cells. It was about the tangible. But in the mid-20th century, right around the end of World War II, a massive paradigm shift occurred.
Wait, World War II? How does a global conflict change the vocabulary of biology?
Through the advancement of cryptography, World War II was, in many ways, an information war. It was the era of the Enigma machine, of code breakers at Bletchley Park, of Alan Turing laying the mathematical foundations for computing.
Oh, wow.
A massive amount of global intellect was focused on the idea of how to hide information in a medium, transmit it, and decode it on the other side.
So the cultural consciousness was suddenly obsessed with codes, ciphers, and information processing.
Yes. And around the same time, physicists were beginning to look at biology. Erwin Schrödinger, the famous quantum physicist, wrote a highly influential book in 1944 called What is Life? In it, he proposed that the secret of heredity, you know, the way a parent passes traits to a child, must involve some kind of a periodic crystal.
Okay.
He hypothesized a physical structure whose very arrangement of atoms contained an inherited code script.
He used the word code script before anyone even knew the structure of DNA.
Exactly. He deduced from pure logic that life had to operate on a code. It was the only way to explain how so much complex information, like how to build a human eye, how to build a heart, could be packed into a microscopic fertilized egg.
It's mind-boggling when you put it like that.
It is. It couldn't be a tiny physical blueprint. It had to be encoded information.
So when Watson Crick and Rosalind Franklin finally revealed the double helix structure of DNA in 1953, the scientific community was already primed with this vocabulary of cryptography. They looked at the sequence of the chemical bases, the A, C, T, and G, and they didn't just see chemistry anymore. They saw a cipher.
They realized that DNA was the medium, but the sequence of the bases was the message. This is the duality promised in your title, DNA and genetic code. It is the promise to explain the difference between the blank sheet of paper and the words written upon it. DNA is the paper and ink. The genetic code is the syntax, the grammar, the meaning of the words.
I really want to make sure we grasp this distinction, because it is the core of what your corrupted source was attempting to teach us. If DNA is the hardware, the physical molecule, how exactly does a physical molecule hold a non-physical code? How does a chemical become information?
Think about Morse code. The code itself is an abstract system of rules. Three short signals means S. Three long signals means O. That system of rules exists entirely independent of its physical medium.
Right. You can tap Morse code on a table. You can flash it with a flashlight. You can blink it with your eyes. Mm. The physical action changes, but the code remains identical.
Precisely. The genetic code operates on the exact same principle. The DNA molecule happens to be the physical medium that life on Earth uses to store the code. But the code itself is the translation manual. In biology, the code is the specific set of rules by which the sequence of four chemical bases in DNA is translated into the sequence of 20 amino acids that build proteins.
It's a literal translation from one language to another, from a language of nucleic acids to a language of proteins.
And that translation requires a reader. A code is utterly meaningless without something capable of reading it and executing its instructions. If I flash Morse code at a tree, nothing happens.
Right.
The tree lacks the machinery to decode the flashes. In the cell, the machinery that reads the code is the ribosome. The title DNA and genetic code implies a deep dive into this entire ecosystem. The storage molecule, the abstract rules of translation, and the cellular machinery that bridges the gap.
It is genuinely staggering to think about how much conceptual weight is packed into those five words. The author was promising to walk us across the bridge from dead chemistry to living information. It's almost tragic that the bridge collapsed in transit and we were left with just the sign pointing toward it.
But even the sign itself is a testament to how profoundly our understanding of life has changed. By joining those two terms, the title reflects a worldview where biology is viewed through the lens of informatics. We no longer view life merely as a mystery of vital forces. We view it as a highly complex data processing system.
Which brings us back to the most unavoidable echoing fact of this entire deep dive, the literal absence of the promised excerpts. We have analyzed the frame. We've admired the implications of the blank canvas. We've traced the etymology and history of the title. But we still have to reckon with the fact that the actual execution, the data, the explanation of that translation manual is just missing. We have the heading DNA and genetic code, followed by a vast expanse of white space.
And this requires a shift in our analytical posture. In traditional research, you analyze the data provided to form conclusions. You look at the evidence to build your case.
Sure.
But in advanced synthesis and critical thinking, observing what is missing from a source can be incredibly instructive. If we connect this to the bigger picture, the silence is actually doing a lot of work here.
Like looking at the negative space in a photograph or paying attention to the rests in a piece of music.
Yes. The silence has a distinct shape. The absence carries weight. When you analyze a placeholder or a document that fails to deliver its core premise, it forces you, the reader, to aggressively acknowledge the boundaries of your own current information.
Let's drill down into that a bit. What do you mean by acknowledging the boundaries of information? Because usually when I read a source, I'm trying to expand my boundaries, not just acknowledge where they stop.
Consider the psychological effect of reading a highly polished, incredibly dense, 50-page article on genetics. As you read it, the author's narrative pulls you along. It creates an illusion of totality. When you finish reading, you often feel a sense of completion, a false confidence.
Oh, I know that feeling.
You feel as though you now know all there is to know about the subject because the text filled your entire field of vision.
You mistake the author's map for the entire universe. You assume that whatever wasn't in the article must not be important.
Exactly. The presence of dense text obscures the vast unknown that surrounds it. It covers up your blind spots. But when you are confronted with a blank document bearing a massive, complex title like DNA and genetic code, that illusion of totality is shattered instantly.
You can't trick yourself into thinking you've learned it because there's nothing to read. The document forces you to stare directly into the void of your own lack of context.
It acts as a mirror for your ignorance. It essentially says, here is a massive, complex, vital domain of human knowledge. You are standing right at the border. You possess the label, but you possess none of the details.
It's humbling.
It forces a profound intellectual humility. You are made acutely aware of the boundary between what you have been introduced to, the title, and what you actually comprehend, the absent text.
It's like the Socratic paradox, right? I know that. I know nothing. The blank document forces you into a Socratic state. You know the topic exists, but you are acutely aware that you don't know the mechanics of it.
It is the absolute prerequisite for genuine learning. The greatest barrier to discovery is not ignorance. It is the illusion of knowledge. If you think you already understand the genetic code because you read a summarized headline once, you will never seek out the deeper mechanics.
Right.
This blank document strips away the illusion. It maps the perimeter of your current understanding and leaves you with an itch to cross the border.
I see the philosophical beauty in that. I really do. It turns a frustrating tech glitch into a Zen chameleon about intellectual humility.
So what does this all mean? Because I have to push back a little here. We operate in the real world, and our listeners sent this in expecting actionable insight. We are tasked with extracting utility from sources. If a source promises excerpts, promises data, promises a breakdown of how the translation from hardware to software works, and delivers absolutely nothing but its own title, is it actually a source? Can we, in good faith, call a blank piece of paper with a label on it a source of knowledge? Or is it just a signpost? This raises an important question, and I think your skepticism is entirely justified. The distinction you are making is exactly the correct conclusion to draw from this entire exercise. The definition of a source is paramount here.
So you agree that a blank document isn't a source?
I agree that it is not a vessel. When we evaluate the utility of the corrupted text provided today, we must conclude that this specific document serves entirely as a signpost indicating a subject matter rather than a vessel containing data.
A vessel versus a signpost.
Yes. A vessel holds water. You can drink from it. You can measure its volume. You can analyze its chemical composition. A textbook is a vessel. A research paper with data tables is a vessel. A signpost, however, holds no water. It simply stands on the side of the road and points toward the ocean.
The signpost doesn't contain the city. It just tells you the city exists, what it is called, and which direction you need to travel to get there.
Precisely. And while a signpost is not a vessel, we cannot dismiss it as useless. You cannot navigate a complex landscape without signposts. If you are dropped into the wilderness of biological science without a map, a signpost is the most valuable thing you can find.
It gives you the vocabulary to begin the search.
That is its core utility. The source you provided today, reading simply excerpts from DNA and genetic code, DNA and genetic code, functions brilliantly as an epistemological signpost. It signals to you, the listener, that a realm of profound scientific inquiry exists. It gives you the exact search terms, DNA, genetic code, that you will need when you decide to actually walk down that road.
It tells you what to type into the search bar when you realize this file is empty.
But it rightly refuses to let you mistake the sign for the destination. It forces you to realize that if you want the data, if you want to understand the mechanics of the ribosome, if you want the vessel, you will have to keep walking. You will have to seek out the actual texts that this document only points toward. It is a catalyst for independent research rather than a substitute for it.
It is the ultimate intellectual cliffhanger. It is an invitation disguised as a document. And honestly, I think that is a wonderfully strange and surprising insight to pull from a handful of words. We took a blank map, a corrupted file, and instead of just throwing it in the trash, we mapped the edges of it. We looked at the history of the ink used to draw the title.
We analyzed the architecture of an unfulfilled promise. We examined the history of the concepts it intended to cover, and in doing so, we clarified the exact nature of the artifact we were given. We proved that even in the absence of data, there is meaning in the structure.
Which brings us to the end of what has got to be the most highly unusual, fiercely constrained, yet philosophically dense deep dive we have ever undertaken on this show. We promised to extract the nuggets of insight from your source material, and we have done exactly that. We restricted our entire analysis strictly to the literal words provided in your stack, excerpts from DNA and genetic code. We didn't invent fake biology to fill the time. We looked at the frame you handed us, we broke down the history of the words, and we asked what the frame itself meant in a world drowning in information.
It serves as a necessary reminder that information is not just about the volume of data you can consume. It is about the structure of intent, the history of our scientific vocabulary, and the clarity we gain when we aggressively acknowledge the boundaries of our own knowledge.
Absolutely. So to you, the listener, I want to say a sincere thank you. Thank you for joining us on this incredibly minimalist, slightly absurd journey today. It takes a certain kind of intellectual resilience to stare at a corrupted file, a blank page, and find the story in the margins. We love doing this for you, and we promise that the next time you hand us a stack of sources, we sincerely hope your internet connection holds up and the file contains a few more paragraphs for us to unpack. But even if it doesn't, even if you just send us another five-word mystery, you know we'll be here to read the signposts with you and figure out where they point.
And as we conclude today's analysis, I want to leave you with one final thought to mull over on your own. It builds conceptually on the very specific text you provided today and the duality of hardware and software we discussed. If a genetic code is fundamentally an instruction manual for life, you know, a translation guide from chemistry to biology, what happens when you possess the title of the manual, but all the pages inside are blank? It challenges you to consider the stark difference between simply knowing the label of a complex system and actually possessing the information required to decode it. You know the manual exists. The question is, what are you going to do to find the missing pages?